Okay, let's go ahead and get started, I guess. We won't officially run up on time. We'll call this close enough on time and get going. I know some of y'all were here yesterday listening to me. Welcome back, glutton for punishment that you are. Today's topic, I'm Courtney Perry. I'm a lawyer here in Atlanta. I teach at Emory as an adjunct from time to time. And today we're going to be talking about basically about copyright protection and how it applies and shouldn't apply and has some real conceptual issues with software and computer applications. Now, on that front, let me give you a little bit of background about me. I've been a practicing attorney for quite some time. I do intellectual property law, and I have taught computer law and things along those lines as well. I am not, however, a big techno person. Y'all know a great deal more about programming, for God's sake, and even running silly computers than I do. So to the extent that you have intense technical questions, yeah, I won't be able to answer. And if I say something extraordinarily stupid from a technical standpoint, flag me, we can talk about it. I know the law really well. Y'all know the tech better than I do. It's the overlap of the two that's problematic, and that's basically the topic for today's talk. As I'm going through, I want to kind of set out some basics about the law, because if we're going to talk about copyright law, you got to know a little bit about it first. So we're going to do just a very short version of what it is on the aspects that are important to show why it's not working well with how it's trying to be applied into the computer realm. And then we can go from there, partially with what y'all are interested in, and partially with just kind of the application of the law and other options that people are trying to find a way to protect their computer work with. First off, with copyrights. The whole point behind copyright law is the protection of expression. One of the problems that we're going to talk about is that it is not intended to apply to facts or processes or any of the underlying substance of a work. If you write a book about, some of the fun cases, we have one about how Dillinger is still alive. John Dillinger didn't actually die out in front of the movie theater. That was all a setup, and he was still alive. A lot of the old gunslingers, people have different theories on how they're still alive. Billy the Kid, I assume, is dead by now, but yeah, was not killed when they said he was. You write a book about that, you put all of your cool historical facts in it, you don't still own those facts. Anything you put in your book that's substantive, the whole point of copyright law is to encourage people to express things and to put stuff out into the public domain, honestly. So you're supposed to write your book, your words are protected, the stuff you're talking about is not. Copyright's meant to protect the expression. There's an entire area of law. If you were stuck sitting in my copyright class, yeah, we'd spend weeks on the distinction between idea and expression. The idea is not protected. Now that's different from patents. If you patent your invention, what's protected is the substantive invention, the science that's going on with what you've created. Your mousetrap. I'm sorry, what?
The technology.
That's what a patent is for. It protects that kind of substance. Copyright's about the expression. It's the pretty. It's the art. It doesn't match with the tech. And we talk about the distinction between idea and expression because that's really at the heart of copyright. You can see already why this is going to be a problem when you get to software. One thing with software is, okay, first off, you've obviously got the two forms of software. You've got your source code, you've got your object code. A couple very clever lawyers snowed a couple otherwise intelligent judges into really deciding that the object code was also expression. Now, when they first started attaching software into the Copyright Act, Congress was revising the Copyright Act. This is back around 1976, 1980s, when they were doing this. And they were trying to decide, first off, they were trying to decide if a digital display was going to be sufficient to make a copy. That was an easy question. It was. Then there was this committee that had been formed that didn't really have much else to do. When you have committees with more budget than task in Washington, they just keep going. So this one continued on and decided that they would address the issue of whether software should be expressly included in the Copyright Act so that software would be protected under copyright law. This was in the 70s and early 80s that they were going through some of this. Now, at that time, we didn't have computers on everyone's desk. It was really more of a Star Trek kind of thing. No one had the computers on their desk. This is, you know, graduate students in Birkenstocks. We were still using punch cards for the computer programming. Those kind of looked like expression, look, it was paper. But at that point, and the people on the committee were not programmers or computer professionals, they were my people. They were lawyers and lobbyists. And this was the conclusion they came to. Congress said, well, we got all these experts together. Well, the experts weren't, and so we're going to put it in the law. And we've been kind of struggling with it ever since. When you try to use it for your software, you're not protecting the stuff that you really need protected, and you're stretching the law around in a stupid way. When you're looking at the object code and source code is a fun one, because first off, most lawyers don't even know what those terms mean. And second off, when you're looking at expressions, remember I started with copyright law is about expression. It's about your choice of words, your choice of art, your choice of notes for your music, it's your choice of colors for your art, it's your choice of words for your books. When you're writing software, how many of y'all actually are programmers? Okay. Good enough. If I said that your job was not creative, you would probably be offended. Obviously, there is some creative work to what you do, how you decide, how you set your programs up, how you design them, how you make the things you want to happen happen. Obviously, it's creative work. With copyright, the restriction, the requirement's very low. Original expression. And originality is a very low standard. It doesn't have to be clever, it just has to be original. But there has to be an author. Now, how many of y'all actually can write in a binary code? Y'all speak ones and zeros fluently? People don't write the binary code part. Your object code comes out of the compiler. Even I know that. This is where, when I talk to my law students, it's kind of funny. Because these kids have never actually written on paper. They're taking the notes from the computer. And they know less about how their computers actually work than how their cars work. And so I'm up here kind of giving the techno speech. And Jason always gets, a friend of mine's up here, always gets a kick out of this because I'm always calling him. Because I'm like, okay, I'm saying this. Is this right? Is this true? Is this right? Okay. So I can give the technical talk, but I still know that much more than both the students who are born this age and experts who are trying to draft the laws. We don't get the tech. That's why object code is subject to copyright. No one chose that expression. That's how you tell the machine to do something. That's a process. It's a set of instructions. Now, oddly enough, copyright knows how to handle instructions. We have rules about instructions. We as lawyers understand instructions. You know, apply to hair, lather, rinse, repeat. Yeah, we know how these instructions work. They're not copyrighted. To the extent there is only one or only a few ways to describe something or say something, it's not going to be copyrightable, even if it's original expression. I'm sure on my lovely cup of Starbucks here, somewhere it said, take the lid off and be careful and drink your coffee. We put instructions on everything. You can't copyright that because if Starbucks was allowed to own, be careful, don't burn yourself, this stuff's hot, take the lid off carefully, it might splash, then what would the nice folks from Caribou Coffee be able to say? We don't let anyone have a monopoly on words that are used for a particular purpose, that the expression is limited. The buttons on your VCR or on your DVD player, play, record. Sony came up with those once and tried to protect them. Said, hey, it's our expression. We're trying to express we're being very original in how we said play, record, stop, rewind. Now, at some point, when those sorts of machines were first invented, they had to decide what words to use there. They, honest to God, tried to get copyright protection for play, stop, rewind, fast forward. And that case didn't go over it, didn't win, but it went several rounds of appeal. But in theory, lawyers know how to handle instructions. Recipes, for instance, are not copyrightable. So in so many ways, you can say, put the eggs and the flour and the sugar together and it'll turn into a cake. And we're not going to allow anyone to own the words that tell you how to do that. Now, if you select a bunch of recipes and put them together in a cookbook, your selection of those recipes, the ones that you choose to put in there, kind of more like an anthology of poetry, those will be, your selection and your arrangement can be protected, but you don't own the recipes. That's not what copyright's about. Yeah?
Well, I can understand if you just draft instructions why that shouldn't be copyrighted, but object code is uniquely defined by the source code that it comes from. So why isn't that just another form of expression of the source code?
Well, unfortunately, that's what the law says it is. And it's protected that way. However, one reason is that it is defined by the source code. It's, the magic that happens, that little compiler box, where what you have written out in your source code, that's how it's going to be expressed to the computer. It's not your original expression. The source code arguably was, the object code is nothing but the mechanics of the instructions for the computer. It's not original. And there's no author, honestly, because the compiler is the original. Is the originator.
Why isn't it the same work, though? Why isn't the object code just another expression of the exact same work?
The problem we get into, and this is exactly kind of where I want to go with this, is that copyright is intended to protect expression. And I'm not saying that your object code should have no protection, but copyright's not the way to do it, because you come into a huge conflict with the fact that it's a set of instructions for a machine. It's the reason that the HVAC system is keeping this at a remotely comfortable level in here, usually not, but this actually isn't bad. That's not expression, that's not creative content, that's gears. It's digital gears making the machine do what the machine's supposed to do. And if it's new art enough, if it's non-obvious enough to qualify for a patent, then sure. But what you're doing is trying to bootstrap really just mechanics into copyright.
Well, I guess my question is still, why aren't you just protecting the source code? Because the reality is that nobody copies source code. They copy the CDs that, or whatever that has the software on it, which is going to be compiled binary. They never copy the source code because you don't even give them that. Unless it's open source, it's a different issue.
Open source is a different issue, too. What we're looking at, though, is that when you're talking about protection, the problem is the protection is not protecting what you need protecting. Copyright law is not meant to do that, because all it's going to protect is the expression. All it's going to protect is how you said it, not what it is. When you're worried about the value to your program, it's what it does. No one cares how pretty you said it. You buy a novel because the words paint pictures in your head. The way it's expressed is valuable for the sake of the art. You know, I'm sure your code is brilliant, and I'm sure that it's not really that fun to read. But it's not, the expression is what the law attaches to. And the expression is not what matters out of your programs. Let me keep going, we'll come back to that. Yeah.
I guess the point here is really, how does copyright deal with translations then? Because most of us who program, a lot of us do it in languages that are directly handled by the computer. They're called, as opposed to compiled, they're own languages. So what we write is directly used by the computer. And really what happens in a compiling process is really a translation from our language, from the language of the code, whether that be a Python language or, you know, a Java language or whatever language that came to. It's translation to a computer language, to a binary language. How does copyright deal with translations then?
A translation is a derivative work. When you own a copyright, let's take one step back to basic copyright stuff again. When you own a copyright, what you get is a bundle of rights. When we talk about a bundle of rights, I always end up thinking of a bundle of sticks. And you can give them away, individually. The right to make derivative works is one of your rights. The right to copy and to reproduce is the obvious one that everyone knows about. No one else gets to make a copy of your shit if you have a copyright on it. Or at least they're not supposed to. They can't do it legally, let's put it that way. So the right to reproduce, the right to make derivative works, and a translation is a derivative work. But you fall back on the issue that it is also very clear in the law that there has to be a human touch in order for it to be copyrightable. There has to be an author. If it's a machine doing it, uh-uh. And there have been cases as computer-generated art, for instance, has come along. There are a lot of different computer programs that make stuff. It's kind of cool. But the basic law that has developed correctly in this one is if there is human guidance involved, then the result will be copyrightable. If it's just a mechanical process, then no. And that came up with colorizing movies, actually. Ted Turner, amongst others, tried to take old movies that were in the public domain, colorize them, and then claim a new copyright and pull things back out of the public domain. That's something that the law generally frowns upon, because once it's in the public domain, we like it to stay there. Public domain is stuff that you can freely use. It's not protected. The copyright's lapsed or was never copyrighted, whatever. So Turner tried to pull a bunch of old classic movies back out of the public domain by colorizing them and saying, oh, now it's a derivative work, and so I own it. Yeah. In large part, that didn't work. The law that developed from that string of cases was that if you had a person picking the colors, then it's okay. Then there's the human aspect to it. You have an author, you have originality, you have expression. Those are the requirements. You have those, good enough. If it's just done with the computers, because now they just go through and colorize without a person being involved, that's not going to be copyrightable. When your code is being translated into something for the computer to use, there's no person doing the translation. It should not be copyrightable. There is no author. There is no authorship.
What?
So why, the thing about the colorizing of movies, I'm not quite sure I understand that. I would assume that if it made any sense at all, it would be...
Oh, see, there is your problem, if it made any sense at all. Never assume that about the law.
But it would be a colorized version only that would go out of, well, it would be copyrighted. Presumably the original one, which was already public domain, would continue to be copyrighted.
Technically, yes. When you do a derivative, when you create a derivative work, when you change an old work, all that you're getting, all you're getting rights to is the changes you made. So exactly, Turner would have owned the colorized versions, but since that was the only thing that he was going to be allowed to be distributed, because he actually owned the physical old black and whites also, he was in effect pulling out of public domain, just by virtue of being clever. I mean, he's a good businessman. There's nothing evil what he was doing, but the effect really was that he was being able to do that because he controlled the physical copies of the black and white ones and was only going to distribute the colored ones and wanted his nice long copyright out of that. So, I mean, it wasn't the end of the world or anything like that, but it was just kind of a little sneaky crap that people tried to move. Yeah.
So where does the line get drawn by how much human intervention? Does the human need to be, choose the colors for each individual slide, for a person? If a human chose the palette for a colorizing film, is that considered enough human intervention?
The human aspect of it does not have to be deep or great. The standards for copyright are really very low. Originality is what we're looking at, and originality as a legal term does not actually mean clever or original the way we would think of it. It basically just means that you created it yourself.
So if someone in the colorizing movies, if someone decides they pick a special palette to colorize the movie, but then there's a program that colorizes the movie.
That still counts. Yeah, that still counts. The human doesn't have to actually physically paint each cell.
So to bring that back into the programming realm, is programmers very consciously do code certain algorithms in the source code, knowing the compiler is going to translate that in a certain way into machine code. That's what a really good programmer does, is they are designing stuff and expressing stuff in certain ways, knowing that it's going to get translated.
Right.
So would that not then make that derivative work, the object code, copyrightable? Because I've now consciously affected it, and the compiler is just a tool, just like a carving tool or a paintbrush, to get to my end result, which is the object code.
Let me make sure that one thing was clear, which will then get back to your question. Object code is, in fact, copyrightable. Yeah. That's the current state of the law.
But no,
it's stupid, but it is the current state of the law. So I wanted to make sure that I haven't set you all off in the wrong direction with that. It is, in fact, currently the law. The reason that you have the problem, though, is that it's not just the object code. I think that's the easier thing to look at and say, this is not human expression. There was no author. You may have set your code up to have that result, but again, the result and the underlying stuff that is happening because of your program is not what's being protected by copyright. All it is the words you choose and how you choose them and how you arrange them. But when you're programming, that's not just done because of the way that you want to be creative. It's not just your expression. You're doing it exactly because of what you said, which is because it will cause the machine to do things in a certain way, both at the level of your ultimate output or whatever your program is doing, and you're even staging your code so that it will be compiled and will be translated in a certain way to do it more elegantly or more efficiently, or crash my computer on a regular basis, whatever it was you were doing essentially in there. But you're being driven by the function and by the necessity of what's going to happen, and that is not copyright, which is why you have come down to problems. You have a lot of lawsuits. There was one especially stupid one that was a Microsoft and an Apple lawsuit, where Microsoft basically wanted to set their, when they realized people actually liked using Apple computers because they were friendly and easier to use and had icons and used Windows and those sorts of things, when Microsoft was still the function-based form. They said, well, gosh, this Apple stuff works pretty well. We're just going to make our screen look like theirs. And there were a couple, Lotus and Borland and a couple of the others tried to do the same thing with some of the accounting softwares. They said, gosh, since yours is pretty, I'll just make mine look like yours. And they didn't exactly copy the code, but they copied what it did. So, and they were saying, oh, but look, it's original in the way that the screen looks. So we ended up trying to decide whether the functionality of click on this and something happens is going to matter, or if it's the fact that the screen might be blue, or that the boxes have pull-down menus. That was at one point original to Apple, but do they get to own that from a copyright standpoint? No. because it's about function. But they were trying to protect their work, which in our capitalist society, you're supposed to have a right to protect what you have made and what you have created, but you shouldn't have to stand up in front of a judge and try to describe the difference between why your pull-down menu with this particular number of words in it is original expression, because clearly it's not. It's a functionality.
So what are you saying would be a more effective way than copyright?
There have been a lot of interesting things coming up. The first obvious answer is patent. If you have come up with a piece of software that really is that clever, it is a process, it can be patentable, but the patent process stinks. It is long, it is expensive, and it takes a very specialized lawyer. I'm not a patent lawyer, by the way. So if you ever are trying to patent your work, I said this to y'all yesterday, if you ever are hiring someone to patent your work, ask that lawyer if he or she is a member of the patent bar. We are, as lawyers, allowed to do pretty much anything, but we cannot practice in the patent area unless we're members of the patent bar. There are certain things we can do and certain things we can do with filing them, but if the lawyer's not really a patent lawyer, then for God's sake, don't give him any money. I'm not a patent lawyer. Don't hire me to file your patent. Hire one of them. But plenty of people will actually take your money and not be members of the patent bar and will file your patent application badly. So that's just the practice pointer for the day. For the love of God, check and make sure it's a real patent lawyer. Let me finish a little bit with this. When you go past the idea of patents, which are limited in effect, because it takes forever to get them, and it's bloody expensive. Copyright attaches when you write it. Copyright's an easy process. Write it, and it's copyrighted. You can file a copy with the Library of Congress and pay you $35 to have official copyright protection, but you don't need lawyers. But you don't need lawyers, and it attaches automatically. That's easy. What people have started doing, which is interesting, is coming up with their own ways to protect it, because copyright doesn't quite work. It has other limitations. All of y'all, when you download software, click on some things. I agree, I agree, I agree. All of y'all are basically familiar with EULAs. What the market has started doing is what the law has not done, which is come up with a way that both the programmers of the world and the Microsofts of the world and the consumers are fairly content with, and it's EULAs. It's an instant shrink wrap or click wrap license. None of us read them. I read them. They're kind of fun. But fun to a lawyer is not the way y'all would use the word fun. I realize that. How many of y'all actually read through an entire EULA? You are probably the only people in the world who have done so. And you all probably also know that when you go to the store and buy a box of software, you actually don't own it. EULAs are end-user license agreements. You are licensing that software from Microsoft. You don't own it. You own the physical copy, the disk. And that's usually all that the EULA promises will work. Oh, if your disk is broken, we'll give you another one. If it took out your entire computer system in the interim, yes, sorry, here's your new disk. The EULAs are pretty harsh. You've seen them. There are a lot of consumer aspects to them that are really problematic from a consumer law standpoint. But the EULAs really work. It, in large part, protects what Microsoft and those sorts of folks need protected from me. Now, not from each other. You have protection against the other programmers, you have protection against the rest of the world. Your license agreements are things that have really moved outside of copyright. And it's a problem, actually, in its own way with the law, because they're making a lot of rights in these license agreements that are much broader for the copyright owner than the copyright law would allow. When you buy a book, it happened yesterday, here we go. A book. I always need a prop. This one's better. This one's the real book. Okay. You buy the book. Obviously, you don't own the words. You own this physical copy of the book. If this were actually mine, not someone else's, I could rip it up. Okay, fine. Ripped it up. This would probably be sad. I can give you this book. I can sell you this book. I can do a lot of things. Now, I can't copy it. But I can do a lot of other things to it because I own this physical piece. When I buy software, I'm not allowed to give it to someone else. I can't, I can read this book and then say, here, your turn, read the book. No, with the software, we can't give it away. We can't, the license agreement says we can't. Yeah.
You need to preface that with, when I buy commercial software under most user abusive licenses, then I can't distribute it.
And we'll start talking about Creative Commons in just a sec, and the open licenses. But so we've developed, in effect, the market tends to take care of itself. So between the creators and the consumers, the market's kind of taking care of it. And these licenses are horrible. When I first started reading them and looking at them, it's also, from a legal standpoint, interesting in that because it's a licensing agreement and not a sale, you fall outside of Article 2 of UCC, which is basic sales law. Pretty much everything you buy and sell in the world falls under basic sales law. Everyone knows those rules. You actually know a lot about the UCC, even though you don't realize it. It's how commerce is done. It's the warranties and stuff that attach in normal sales and a normal trade. If you have someone who's a professional seller and a good, they're called a merchant, and they have certain obligations to consumers as opposed to other merchants. It's all very complex. There are a whole bunch of people who write a lot of academic crap about it, and it works. Because the licensing software is taken outside of the sale of goods and is the licensing of goods, none of those old sales laws apply. So your basic fitness for particular purposes, your merchantability, warranties don't attach. So it's the licensing is a really sneaky, evil thing, but it works. No one wants to have to sit on the phone with Microsoft and negotiate a damn license just so they can buy the latest version of Windows. You want to just buy it and install it on your computer and wish that there were a better alternative and just move along with your life. I'm sure that I'll actually use something better than that. But for those of us who are stuck in our limited abilities, yeah, Microsoft is all over my computer, and I don't want to have to negotiate with Bill Gates every time I need a new version of it. I want to click, I agree, and then have it start eating my computer.
So if I'm not buying software, I'm actually licensing it, what happens when I put it on my computer and I lend my computer to you? And you haven't paid for the license. Would they say that you're illegally using their product?
Usually, it's going to depend completely on the terms of their licensing. That could actually be an illegal use. Usually, the way the standard ones are right now, the terms tend to be you may install it on one computer. And as long as it's only on one computer, other people can use that computer. But I have seen EULAs that say, no, you may use this program, and if you loan the computer to someone else, you are violating this contract, and we're going to come after you and do horrible things to you. Yeah.
So it was my understanding that certain licenses, like a GPL, are copyright-based licenses, so they're licenses versus a contract. So the GPL doesn't fall under contract law, so all the basis of contract law doesn't apply to something like the GPL.
That's not true.
Okay, that Lawrence Rosen, I think, in his book on open source licenses.
Lessig?
I don't know.
I'm familiar with Lessig's work.
Not Lessig, no. Okay. Rosen, he's San Francisco open source lawyer.
Okay.
He specifically states that the GPL, and that's why he advocates a contract-based, using a contract-based form for EULAs, versus something like the GPL, which is a license-based form, which is specifically relying on copyright, it's not creating a contract.
There's two aspects to that. If I'm following what you're saying, part of what he said is correct and part of what he said is wrong. We use the term licensing in a number of different ways. When you are talking about, remember I talked about copyrights, you have your little bundle of sticks, your bundle of rights. I have the right to make copies, I have the right to make derivative works, I have the right to do all kinds of crap. And I can give those rights to other people. I can sell those rights to other people. I can give them away for free. I can give them for a short period of time. I can give them for an extended period of time. And I can give them either exclusively or not. I can say, okay, you are the only person who can have my sticks. That sounds a little naughty. You are the only person who can make copies of my work. You are the only person who is allowed to make a derivative work of my work. Or I can say, yeah, sure, go ahead. And you can too, and you can too. Yeah. It's up to me. All of those things are allowed under the law, and so I'm basically divvying up my copyright, my rights and my work. I can divvy it up however the hell I want to do. And that's what most of the open source agreements are, is basically just a statement of, I am telling anyone who wants to that they can use my work under these certain terms. Now, from a contract standpoint, that's a little dicey, because we like contracts to be between one person and another person. We like to know who contracts are with. Well, we've been talking about EULAs for a while already, though. These sorts of contracts of adhesion is actually what I would call them, where you don't have a choice. If you want this, you are stuck with this contract. And so basically what the open source agreements are, Lessig's folks, the different versions of the general purpose license and the limited licenses, you're giving away those copyrights, but it's done through a contract. The license agreement, in effect, is when you're giving away your licensing out your rights. And a contract still applies, but it's an open-ended contract, and it's a little weird. The law has been deciding over time that those are going to be enforceable. That even though it's not normal, and lawyers don't like when things change or different, we get very edgy, and we look at it for a very long time. And so these are obviously not brand spanking new, but recently we've pretty much come to the conclusion that they're enforceable. But anytime you're giving away your rights and copyright, you have two different overlapping areas of law. One is the copyright aspect of it, and how you can give the stuff away and the enforceability and what can be given away and when it comes back to you, which it does automatically in your copyright law, is the copyright level of it. On top of that, you have certain concepts of contract, which anytime people are agreeing something, those basic rules of contract do apply. You can't take it outside that.
In a GPL, do you actually have consideration there, though, to form an actual contract? Don't you need consideration to form a contract?
Yes, but there's sufficient consideration there and giving it out.
And when I'm giving it, I, the person receiving it obviously is getting the value, but what am I getting by giving it out?
That's a very long answer. Okay. I can answer that, but everyone else is going to fall asleep. I'll be happy to talk to you after about it, but there isn't, it suffice to say that yes, there's sufficient consideration there, and the contract is binding.
Okay.
And if we had it, I can give you the whole contract lecture, but no one wants to do that. Yeah.
What about the voidability of licenses? One of the more popular ones is Microsoft's license. If you don't like our terms, return the CD to the vendor that you purchased it from and receive a set refund. And that goes in their OEM contracts in general. And a large number of
them. I missed a few words. Can you repeat it?
Sure. The Microsoft agreement on most of their OEM software says that if you receive the software on the computer and you're not happy with the agreement, you don't want the software, return the software to the vendor, and you'll receive a certain amount of refund. A number of vendors are notorious for not honoring that provision. And so you have no way, therefore, to reject the contract and get your money back, so you still have the software.
In theory, if you send it back to Microsoft, they'll send you the money.
That's never happened either.
Yeah.
Preloaded, there's
no
copy to send.
Yeah. I really didn't want this after all. Yeah, I finished the meal, but it wasn't very good. Yeah. Absolutely, that's a problem with the licenses. They're not fair. They suck for consumers, frankly. Microsoft has written them, and I say Microsoft, like a great evil empire, but they really are the ones who spearheaded that. And if we had another couple hours, we could talk about USITA, which was this nice anti-consumer law that they also spearheaded, which fortunately did not get through very far. But they really have been fairly active from both legislative and a legal standpoint. But the Microsoft licenses, which everyone has been using, they're evil. I mean, there's no way around it. These guys have good lawyers and a lot of leverage and say, if you want our stuff, here are the terms you can have it on. Now, I don't have a problem with that in general because that's how the market works. If there were a better product out there, then we'd buy it. Y'all probably do, actually.
Yeah.
But but for those of us that have to deal with the rest of the world and not with computers, yeah, we have to use that because that's what everyone uses. So the terms are unfair, absolutely. Getting your refund, yeah, good luck with that. If the store you bought it from, or if licensed it through, will give you the refund, that's great. If not, you're out of luck. And the terms say that you can reject the contract, and that's necessary, that's actually a legal thing too. If when you get a one-sided contract like that, you must have the option to say no. You can't negotiate it. Well, you could. Yeah, you can call Bill Gates up and say, you know, this term in section 14.3, they'll say, that's nice, don't buy it. Market works that way, and that's why the license agreements have become so popular, because that's what we want. We want to be able to click, I agree, and have the damn thing show up. I want to be able to either go into the store and get a box, or I want to be able to go online and download the silly thing. I don't want to have to think about it. I don't want to have to wait. I don't want to have to make a deal. I want to buy this like a consumer good. But because of the piracy issues, the licensing agreements are pretty much what the industry has been putting in to try to protect themselves, not completely sufficient. Yeah.
I was going to say, the thing is, as a little broad here, most people don't like the EULAs, and they understand them, and anybody who's educated about them understands them to be consumer abusive and user abusive.
Oh, yeah,
and
completely.
So it's not a we that wants the licenses. It's the monopoly industry that forced them down people's throats.
Right. And no, the agreements, like I said, I think I'm usually not a real consumer advocate kind of person. Most of my practice, not as a big firm, so I've worked for the big evil empires. And it's where most of my training's gone. And I'm not the I tend to be kind of a big fan of, well, I clicked, I agree, therefore I agree. It's not that hard to say, but it was a bad deal and I wish I hadn't made it. Yeah, too bad. Buy something else next. But they're really, really harsh agreements. And they really are one-sided, and they really are fairly abusive. Your remedies are incredibly limited. That they usually have arbitration clauses, which I just think are one of the most abusive things, because if you, by virtue of clicking I agree, one thing that you've agreed away is your right to go to small claims court and sue to get your refund or whatever, and small claims court was set up for humans to be able to go to redress small issues, you know, small being usually under $5,000 issues, without my people. You don't have to take one of us along. Every time you take one of us along, you have to check with us because we're pricey. And you should be able to resolve it with Microsoft in small claims court. One of the things you agree to by clicking that little box is arbitration, which everyone thinks sounds nice and fuzzy because it's like, oh, that way you don't have to go to a formal court. No, arbitration is worse than litigation. It's more expensive. And in your EULA, you've agreed to do it in Washington State usually. Sometimes they take it further and take it offshore somewhere. You have to go to Zanzibar to resolve your dispute. And, you know, it's sort of unconscionable, but the courts have been enforcing them. And, yeah, no, they absolutely are consumer abusive. But so far, we're putting up with it. If someone would sell a better product or an equally good product on better terms, the market would probably reward that person. Yeah.
I have a question. I mean, I can understand how patents would cover if I make a new thing that's just like a new encoding for video that's like much more efficient. Mm-hmm. I can see that a patent would cover that. If I write something like a new word processor, mm-hmm. if there's nothing new in it, that's really not patentable.
Right.
So are you saying that any, you know, at that point I really can't sell that because anyone can copy it because it's not copyrightable?
Well, again, let me make sure that I'm clear. The law currently is that it is copyrightable.
Right, yes, I understand.
But understand that what's being protected is not your cool word processor that you just created. How the words are crunched and what your program does is not being protected by the copyright anyway.
Well, okay, so let me...
The words you chose to make it happen are what's being protected. Someone can't blankly copy it, but when you... The reason you end up with a lot of, frankly, expensive and stupid copyright litigation that, I mean, y'all's industry is just getting sucked into. My folks are getting very rich off of you. And one of the reasons is because the law doesn't fit, so we're making really stupid arguments. Because we have to try to explain why we all kind of agree that you should, if you can create a new word processing program that's better than this crap that I have from Bill Gates. I'm just word perfect, frankly. It was a much better.
It's still around.
Yeah, I know, but no one else can read my... if you could create a better word processing system, then you should have some protection in that. And even if it's not patentable because it's not high, it doesn't reach that high standard of non-obvious and novelty, which is a very high standard. I said the copyright standard is very low. The patent standard is high. Now, recently the patent office has been stupid, but...
The standards of the USPTO are not high.
The standards of the USPTO are just completely whacked out right now. There is nothing rational coming out of that office. I don't know what's in the water, but they have lost touch with the mothership. They are giving patents for stuff that is unbelievably dumb. One patent lawyer, because he could, gave his 10-year-old kid the patent on swinging on a swing sideways. One of my business school students brought that up to me in one of the lectures. I'm like, oh, you're just full of shit. And no, there's I looked it up on the database. There is an honest-to-God patent number for, instead of swinging forward and back, you sit sideways on the swing and go the other way. That's patented. And it's a 10-year-old kid's patent. I mean, his dad happens to be a patent lawyer. Whoops. But, I mean, that issued. That should not issue. They're giving, I mean, the whole idea in the patent law, like I said, I'm not a patent lawyer. You're not allowed to patent live things. You can't patent a chicken. They're patenting chickens. Natural phenomena are not supposed to be patentable. Something you invent can be patented. Something you discover, like gravity, is not supposed to be patentable. They're patenting DNA strands. They're patenting diseases. Wow. The black letter law says you can't do that. So there's going to be a correction in that. The patent in law, as in many things, you get the whole pendulum swing going on. But if you get sideways, it's patented, so you can't do that. And right now, the patent folks, like, they have just fucking lost their minds. And it'll come back. It'll swing back the other way, and it'll be very restrictive again. And in software, they're confused because it's supposed to be a higher standard. The old diamond paste set what the standard's supposed to be, so it can't just be any software. It has to be a particular... And they don't understand that either. But that will self-correct eventually. That's one of those legal things.
This is also talking.
So if I understand what you're saying, if I ignore the EULA, if I got a copy of words and I literally rewrote it, and instead of using if statements, I use case statements, or, you know, I basically literally changed the code, even though it did the exact same thing, you know, but that's a different expression.
If you could use different words to make it do the same thing, and you were basing it on the functions of what they did, that would be legal under copyright law.
Okay.
So the stuff that matters for Microsoft is not those words you're using, but what it does. Right. And what it does is not subject to copyright protection. So it's, the law is not helping what you value.
So what you're saying is that we should have something new that isn't copyright law.
Now, trade secrets, there's been a couple of different approaches to it. Trade secret law is kind of a user-friendly way that I think what would make the most sense, honestly, is an expanded version of trade secret law. There's been a couple different attempts at it, some computer fraud acts and things like that, where the problem has, where they've tried to come up with solutions. No one's quite done it yet, and again, when my people legislate about computer stuff, it's just really, really stupid, because we don't really understand it. I've mentioned briefly about USITA, which was a Computer Information Technology Act. It was supposed to be like the new sales law for computer stuff. The day before it was finalized in front of the big committee of academic folks, we were in a room, you know, one of these boring hotel rooms, with the experts who had written this law, and they were trying to decide what the hell a computer was and what computer information was and how it was going, what actually would fall under the definition. Now, my people are good at definitions, it's what we do. And we didn't know. Now, this was a number of years ago, but they were debating whether it would apply to digital cameras. Now, this was, let's see, that meeting was in 99. No one in the room owned a digital camera. They weren't exactly sure how they worked, but because it had the word digital, they were pretty sure that it might involve a computer, maybe. But these guys, honest to God, could not say for sure whether this law they had just written would apply to digital camera. Obviously, it would have. And to cars, anything with a computer chip was going to end up being covered by this. And so instead of buying a car under a sales act, you're going to buy it under this. But these guys weren't sneaky. Actually, the Microsoft chip in there was sneaky. Most of them were just stupid. And they didn't know, yet they were trying to draft this law ahead of the development of commerce. They were trying to define in 99 what laws would govern electronic agents, so that, you know, when your warehouse runs out of something, your computer can tell the manufacturer's computer to send us some new of these. You know, I'm out of these kinds of widgets, please send them along, people don't have to do it anymore. That's very commonplace now. It was fairly cutting edge then, and these guys didn't even understand that level of how an electronic agent would work and when a contract would be formed, and they were trying to make laws to apply to it. Usually with technology, as fast as it's going, you have to kind of wait for the law to catch up. And we're trying to find ways to protect that. Y'all, I mean, the Lawrence Lessig folks, the free use folks and open source work, a lot of it y'all are kind of doing on your own as a strange computer community. Here's open source stuff, use it under these terms. Use it kind of nicely, don't go gouge other people, we're all sharing and it's kind of working. Obviously, sometimes you don't want to share. And then you have problems, but the reality is, if you come up with that really good word processor, sell it quick. Because if someone else steals it from you, then whoever gets to the market better. And that is unfair, but it's kind of been how the market's always worked. So to a certain extent, we come back to, yes, so what, it's computers, but we've had the same problem with innovation all along. Yeah.
One of the more recent phenomenons are the slap suits of people asserting copyright for things that are really dubious.
Yeah.
In a manner in such that you don't have the resources to fight them. Mm-hmm. Blizzard pulled it in recent history in a way that upset much of the defense. Is there a good way to stop that sort of hey, I'm going to say it's copyright,
right,
but you don't have enough money to tell me it's not?
That is actually a phenomenon all the way across the legal world. It's not just in copyrights. And it's done with, I mean, obviously patent cases. That's been one of the big patent things. I mean, the BlackBerry case, all their stuff, where you have people who don't actually invent anything, but they're just patent houses. They file patents and file patents and file patents, then wait for someone else to actually invent and then say, oh, look, this is kind of what I said I had in my patent, and so now I'm going to keep you from doing it. So, I mean, it's made some destructive people very rich in the patent area. And it's done in copyrights as well, and it can be done in anything. I mean, the slap suits, that's an old legal term. It's not a new tech term. It's just it's a harassment suit. And there are supposed to be ways to keep it from happening. I mean, there are actual sanctions for an attorney who brings that kind of thing. But if there are, you know, even reasonable merits, you're allowed to bring it to the courts. And, God, I mean, we get into tort reform and talk like that to figure out how to stop the abuse of suits. And I've got no good answer for that. Because it's really using the legal system to support anti-competitive market practices. And it's an abuse of the legal system. That makes me very unhappy. This is my world. They shouldn't be screwing with it. But it's being done very broadly and widely, and I have not seen anything that's going to, I mean, basically the best way is to have good judges who will look at it and roll it fast, but the court systems are backed up. Lawyers drag everything out. Litigators are just awful, awful people. And they drag stuff out forever and ever and ever, and they get rich off of it, and yeah. I got no answer for that one, because yeah, it does suck. And it's anti-competitive, and it's bootstrapping monopolies they're not supposed to be. Yeah.
Not to throw a huge switch at that, but doesn't the European Union copyright statute, like the ease of buying everything now, you can buy stuff from Amazon UK and all
right.
that stuff, doesn't that change it all around? Because like in music, all of the Elvis recordings go out of copyright this year in Europe. And so you can bootleg all the Elvis you want legally in Europe.
Actually.
That's not right. I thought it was 50 years. It's and that
years
is,
after death.
Yeah.
With copyright, there are a number of different answers to that question. The first one is we are a member of the Berne Convention, so a lot of the laws are going to be uniform across Europe and through here. The law of locality are the ones that count, though. So to the extent they have shorter terms there, that will attach. The Elvis stuff, actually, most of it was copyrighted under our earlier copyright laws, which gave you two short terms if you renewed them, and it was not the life plus 50 or life plus 70 that it is now. So stuff fell out into the public domain much more quickly. I mean, that was a big issue that people were upset about recently also, as we keep extending the copyright protection. But I think that if most of the European terms are the same as ours or longer. If there's a, I honestly don't know when Elvis's stuff is going to fall into the public domain. But the terms of the international treaties are going to control it somewhat. But you do, to an extent, get whoever has the shortest one is the one that everyone's going to buy through. We can also, if it's pirated goods, you can keep it from being imported if you get the tariff folks involved.
But if it's,
if it's legal there, you can bring it back here.
Produce it here.
Yeah.
You know, and if you legally buy it there, because you're not massive importing,
right?
You can respond to your copy.
And so.
You know, Amazon, yeah. Thailand, whatever.
Right. What you will find is that we were actually one of the last countries to join the international copyright conventions, and that's when we changed our laws around significantly to more comply with the rest of them. There's actually an interesting twist to the European law also, because theirs is based on a very different theory than ours, which is probably not what you want me to talk about. But there are a lot of kind of interesting variations between the European laws and ours. But yeah, I mean, that's just kind of one of those fun flukes of internet commerce, is that we can get shit from anywhere now. I always wonder how the folks down the dealer's room have been impacted by that, because
yeah,
it used to be you had to go to one of these to get your cool Captain Kirk stuff. Now you can get anywhere. But yeah, I guess Elvis is going to be in the public domain soon. Yeah.
Haven't we seen the all of MP3 folks kind of change how the U.S. is going to treat intellectual property that's purchased for a long
time? The whole transition of music into digital form has proven just how stupid industry can be. that's just a whole different topic altogether, how badly the music industry has been trying to keep their, I mean, musicians ought to make money for what they do. Y'all ought to make money for what you do. Musicians ought to make money for what they do. Piracy is bad. And there ought to be ways to keep it from happening. The music industry has done worse. I mean, Microsoft at least has the EULAs out there. They have some, you know, copy protections I assume y'all can blow through. I can't, but most of y'all can. Of course, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says you're not allowed to. Well, you know, you're not allowed to speed either. So there's a lot of different layers that have been the software industry's done a better job of kind of coming up with ideas. The music industry just got hit by a big stupid stick. They first did a whole lot of, oh, well, hopefully no, it won't catch on. That was the best I could tell that their strategy was, no, people like owning discs. This whole MP3 thing won't catch on. Digital copies, they were worried about it because they knew that unlike old audio tapes where you had multi-generational copies, the later ones sucked. Obviously, the cool thing about digital is you make the numbers of copies go on purpose. And they just did a lot of this and instead seemed to turn their attention to making really bad deals with their musicians and kind of bleeding the crap out of the musicians, which has hurt the entire music industry also. And it just kind of turned on itself and fed. And then they tried really clever things like, oh, let's sue some token college students. That'll teach everyone. Napster is very boring from a legal standpoint. Because, yeah, it's infringement. Yeah, they're making a little copies. So, but the industry really never came up with a clever way to do it. They were behind a lot of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act stuff, so we're not supposed to be able to legally go through the anti-circumvention devices, but they just blew it. Yeah.
You said earlier that you were going to get on to Creative Commons. I'm wondering, number one, if you can address that for just a minute.
Yeah.
Also, I don't know if you've looked at all the GPL3. It's one of the, an update of the general public license going on now to try and protect the open source industry from the patent and copyright abuses of the larger monopoly, the corporate monopolies and such. I don't know if you've looked at the language of that at all or have an opinion on that. If you do, I'd love to hear it.
I don't know if I've looked at the exact one that you're talking about. I've looked at a bunch of the ones that are out there. There are better ones, worse ones.
The license that is looking for approval from the community right now.
Okay.
GPL3.
I've not actually looked at that language. It's interesting when they send them out for approval from the community because y'all aren't lawyers. And a lot of it, I looked through a whole bunch in prep for this, and because I practice in this area, I've looked at a lot of the general licenses that are out there. A lot of them suck. If you actually want to, if you have products that you value, that you want to use kind of one of these shareware kind of open source licensing agreements, if it really matters to you and it's something that you honestly God do want to protect because it has commercial value, get one of my people to help you out because some of those licenses just really stink and they do not do what they try to do. What they try to do is cool. So you're basically, it's not that unique from a legal standpoint. What's unique is that it hasn't come from lawyers, it's come from the people who create the product. You're trying to find a way to meet your needs as a community of we want to be able to share some things freely but not let someone else then exploit my clever code, and I want to kind of limit the terms on which it can be used. And that's neat. From a copyright standpoint, that's absolutely legal. From a contract standpoint, it's absolutely enforceable. That took a little while to get to, but that's accepted now. So you're in good shape with that, but the words in your contract matter a lot because like any other contract, the actual terms and the drafting matter a great deal.
Sure.
And a lot of them stink. A lot of them look like they were drafted by computer programmers.
The GPL3 is being drafted by lawyers. The people who are commenting on it from the community have had exposure to ULIS, have understood
right.
the industry very well. And so their feedback is valid even if they aren't lawyers.
Oh, no, absolutely. Clients are supposed to read the contracts and make sure that we get the terms right.
Yeah.
Clients don't usually read the contracts. But they're supposed to, because y'all understand the substance better than I do. I understand the contract better than you do. That's how it works. They'll have our areas of expertise. And some of them are really very good. Now, there are lawyers and there are lawyers. A lot of litigators try to draft contracts, and yeah, they should. I don't go to court. I'm a corporate lawyer. This is the kind of shit I do. I don't do trials. The guys who do trials think they can do anything. It's kind of like surgeons. It gets the ego going. So that particular language, I don't really have an opinion on because I have not studied it enough to say anything. A lot of them are good.
And Creative Commons?
I think that was just, that from a academic standpoint, I thought was fascinating, that it really was kind of a groundswell of we need to be able to share our stuff, we need to be able to find ways to do it, and that it got such a groundswell that everyone, that it really was a community effort in effect. And again, since I'm a lawyer, we don't share, we don't play well with others. To see basic legal terms being used in a way that has enabled a lot of different information to flow more freely, I think is fabulous. And I think that it's a neat way to take the law as it is and apply it in a meaningful but yet useful way for what y'all are doing. And I think it's unique. I do not know of anywhere else where something like that's being done except in this industry. And Lessig, the guy who is behind a lot of it, is a little naive in some areas, but really a very smart person who's been doing a good job with the substantive formation of it was actually sound from a legal standpoint. If you can give them a tangible thing, they do find it easier. But like I said, I just completely disclaim anything coming out of the patent office right now. They've lost their minds. In theory, you make it easier for them. You show them a machine and it's easier. But software on its own, if it meets the standards, can also go through.
Okay.
But in terms of what's easier, to an extent, they like things, but it's not really necessary. And again, it's so bloody random right now. Man, you may as well go to Vegas, your odds are not the same.
Yeah, but aren't these license agreements kind of like saying, like, I'm not selling you a vacuum cleaner. I'm giving you the license to suck dirt out of your carpet. And yeah. You're not allowed to disassemble the vacuum cleaner to see how it sucks the dirt out of your carpet.
They're creating their own rights out of it. And yeah, they're taking it outside of the sale goods realm. It's an intellectual property issue, so it is the process that's being protected. And the license, I mean, I'm not quite sure what...
Well, no, I'm thinking like if they were to take like a license agreement for software and apply it to just, you know, any other physical good.
That actually is a concern. It's one of the issues from a copyright standpoint that makes people like me a little nervous. Since we've taken software to an extent, we allow these license agreements. The way that license agreements actually interact with copyright law is a little creepy because the standard EULA violates basic terms of copyright law. It is granting narrower rights than you would have. It's taking away some of your fair use rights. It's taking away a lot of first sale doctrine rights by terms of the license. So you're really restricting more than the copyright law would restrict. And all you have to do is shrink wrap it and make it an agreement. And there's really no reason we can't start doing that on other things as well. But if I wanted to sell you a vacuum cleaner with absolutely no warranty and I wanted to lease it to you instead of sell it to you, I could do that now too. But people wouldn't fall for that crap because that's not how vacuum cleaners are done. That's just a market correction. Now, we are at time, so if any of y'all have... we filled our hour, so if any of y'all are ready to bolt, please feel free to do so. I will still stand here and take questions, but I know that we are at our official hour cutoff point.
Well, you still have another half hour.